This is a production of Cornell University.
We'll go ahead and call this meeting of the GTSA to order. So this meeting, we have a very straightforward agenda. We have two presentations, and if there's time, we'll have some updates from any committee chairs who have something they want to share with the assembly. So first, we'll do roll call of the voting members. So, Reuben.
Nope.
Chris, for the biological sciences. For the social sciences, Sandra. Biological sciences, Paige is here. Humanities, Jesse. Biological sciences, Sarah is here. Social sciences, Margaret. Masters, Khalid. Veterinary medicine, Amy. Social sciences, William. Physical sciences, Nate is here. Humanities, Christy. Social sciences, Todd. Physical sciences, Tiffany. For law, Julian. For physical sciences, I'm here. Physical sciences, Catherine.
Okay.
And for the humanities, Christine.
Here.
All right. All voting members, please raise your placards to verify that we do have a quorum. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. We do have quorum. So, with that, we'll move right on to our presentation. First up, we'll have an update on policy 6.4. So I will now turn it over to you.
I think it's working.
Really in response to a lot of federal guidance.
started looking at her revision since then during the last academic year, early in the last academic year. That kind of was lost on a few people. That was really in response to a lot of changing institutional needs that were brought. So after the revision in 2012, we kind of tested out the system for a while and realized that there were some things that needed to change in terms of workflow needing to be spread around in different ways, things to make it a bit more intuitive, and for students and anyone else who is coming to seek resources or file reports or complaints under this policy. Additionally, we looked at a lot of federal guidance that came from the Office of Civil Rights. A lot of other institutions received their dance cards, and they'd like to say it was through the Chief University of Pennsylvania for you. People received their dance cards from the Department of Education, and we're entering into consent agreements and other things. So looking at that guidance, what were some of the top things that the Department of Education was saying to these institutions in terms of maybe their office structure or other things that need to be put in place? And you might have heard this interview thing in your state for a little while. Over the summer, pretty interesting in July, the New York State passed Enough is Enough, or 129B, which is a pretty big comprehensive piece of legislation that's directed at all institutions of higher education in New York State, both private and public. And we'll go over what that means. And so that really prompted a really big look at this particular policy. And one thing we also want to make clear is that this is really just, this is one piece of a very comprehensive approach to addressing sexual violence and sexual misconduct on this campus. So what we're giving you today is a very narrow piece. We're focusing on the policy and the procedural process part of it, not necessarily the education and prevention piece that is still very, very much important and really kind of being handled elsewhere. We're also involved in the process, and we all have a big role in what you're going to say is just a small part. So enough is enough. What exactly does that entail? Quite a bit, actually. These are some of the big highlights of what was actually in this piece of legislation. Now, detailing very briefly, the big one that came out of this was affirmative consent, being the definition of that. So that really changed the notion of no means no to yes means yes. So we've heard that. So consent must be knowing, voluntary, and mutual. And the definition goes into include information about how silence does not infer, does not mean consent, and also lists a few more guiding principles on alcohol and other drugs and a couple of other examples that are in there. So if you look at the policy, we've included those same guiding principles straight from the piece of legislation into our policy. The Student Bill of Rights was also something that was included in that act. So this is not to be confused with the Community Bill of Rights, but I know each of the assemblies is working on collectively. This Student Bill of Rights is very specific. It's 11 items that are really put in place to protect the process for all parties. And they enumerate a bunch of things that the institution will do and that the students themselves or complainants have the right to do, as well as the alcohol and other drug amnesty that's pretty consistent with the disciplinary protocol that you all may know about. This is really an extension of that particular piece of that. This is something that we've already had in place. Interim measures, something else we already had in place in our policy, but what we did was change the language just a little bit to make it a bit clearer for people to understand that all parties have the right to appeal these interim measures that are put in place if they may feel that they're concerned enough, or if they may feel they are worse restricted in that case. I'm sure you guys are responsible for that. I'm doing a nod right now. So an interim measure that should define how it is to step once somebody files a report and is triaged by Jody and myself and or Alan's office, these are the steps that are put in place to protect the party. So it might be a no contact order, it might be temporary suspension. Carol will talk about it a bit more. Housing accommodations, schedule changes, things like that. Those would be interim measures of interim accommodations. Appeal by panel. Before the policy, it was clear that it's only the vice president of a particular unit, in this case, either be Susan Murphy or now Barney or Mary Opperman, who is the person hearing the appeal. This is made it clear to you, it's clear that it has to be by a full panel who is able to appeal that position. The transcript notation is the person who is found responsible of a violation under this policy. There's a specific language that has to be included on their transcript going forward. And there's a process and procedure in place to get that removed after a certain amount of time has elapsed. on the subject. I'm not sure if graduate students actually got that survey. Did graduate students participate in the AAU? Okay. So then you all are aware of the AAU survey, and those are the folks that came out. So every other year now, we must do a final assessment of people and to get a better understanding of people's knowledge of who the title line coordinators are, what the overall climate is around here in terms of understanding the resources that are available to each of all people and things like that. And then, of course, there are some very specific provisions for ongoing training and education of specific populations. There's a specific language for athletes, a specific language for first-year students, including graduates and professional students, and for all of those individuals who are involved in the adjudication process. Jody, whether it's probably the title line coordinator, whether it's the review panel, and other individuals like that. So all of that is very specific in that policy. So that's what kind of prompts all of this. So those are all the things we put into the interim policy. We decided in an effort to be compliant by October 5th, which was the good faith compliance date, the effective date for 129B, we would simply do an interim policy that would put all the absolutely necessary things in place so that we could start the academic year with one policy. So we wouldn't change everybody and change kind of in the middle of October and say, by the way, here's this policy as opposed to what we were acting or what we were abiding by 2 months ago. So that's what we did. We put these things in place. So I'm not going to go through all of them again just person, but understand that all the definitions are now consistent with what New York State says. The big substantive change was more of a personnel process change, which the JA's office no longer handles investigations. So all investigations have been moved out of the office to workforce policy and labor relations. So the JA's office, the JA's office handles intake, accommodation, and informal resolutions. Allen's office deals specifically with the investigations overall as well as resolving formal complaints and formal resolutions. So that's the big substantive change that came out of the interim policy. The rest of it, again, is environment clear. And of course, if you had noticed, we had a slight change in leadership at the institution, where they very small, definitely modest celebration that was had in terms of inauguration. So we really had to make sure we updated all the titles of different individuals, the vice presidents and the president himself, and the different offices that were involved in this process to make clear where people were supposed to go, where they could go to these references. So the new policy says, what will that look like? Well, we don't know yet totally exactly what this will look like. None of this is set in stone at this point. But we did want to make sure that the policy is a lot more intuitive and easier to read and very accessible for people. So if you go and Google search the policy now, or look at the share request to go view it, you hope it will get 67 pages of a lot of new links and some stuff that is really complex. And a lot, and in many cases, very difficult for people to understand. Working group just to kind of get a better understanding from all constituencies So you can do that twice now. We have one more meeting at a later date to come and actually review the draft that have come up. We've done that. Carol and Jonathan, their working group to focus on teachers. And we put in that interim policy. You may have heard, or should have heard by now, that we moved it to a central reporting structure, so what was known as the reporting bias system has morphed into, still a reporting bias, but has morphed into the one form for reporting policy, not just bias, but anything that falls under 6.4, and in addition to Haiti and other criminal activity or broader community discussions. So there's one form of that, but it's the one place that we're very easy to deal with that. This case of clients and past that date, so there for us. And now we're in the process of stakeholder review. It's telling everybody exactly what's going on, giving some primary feedback on the process thus far. And then we'll be full compliance and have everything pretty much settled by the July 2016, which is kind of a conclusion of next semester. So with that, I'm going to turn it off over to John and Carol, who will detail a lot of the procedures that they've been working on.
Thanks for listening. I'm Jonathan Potrano. I'm a member of the law faculty, though I'm on leave, and I'm currently the Senior Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, also the Interim Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education. With me is Carol Grombach. She also formerly taught at the law school, and she's now serving in the provost office in a variety of roles that are now reflected in her title. But what we're here to do, Ulysses has mentioned the changes that have led up to the interim policy that's currently in effect, and in some sense is a stopgap measure. What we want to talk about is the fuller set of policy revisions that are underway, and we're here as part of a process of rolling those out to the various campus constituencies to get their input. So let me back up a little bit and talk about how we got there. Ulysses mentioned it as well, but I want to reinforce certain things. What we're talking about is policy on campus dealing with sexual assault and sexual misconduct. The current policy was adopted in 2012 in response to the first initial involvement of the federal government in this area, plus multiple problems we were experiencing with using this ordinary campus code of conduct to adjudicate these kinds of claims. The campus code, as you may know, calls for a very robust kind of trial by combat hearing with lots of cross-examination testimony, those escalate. The concern with that is that in this particular context, in the context of sexual assault, sexual misconduct, and sexual violence, that level of process, whatever value it may have, one might question fact-finding value generally, but was had to be measured against the fact that such processes are extraordinarily discouraging, very clearly showing that evidence, extraordinarily discouraging to victims coming forward who would quite honestly fear that they would be essentially re-victimized by the very cost of taking a given from redress. So as a result of these in 2012, there's quite a radical shift in our approach to this particular kind of case. They were removed entirely from the campus code. Instead of this long trial kind of hearing, all that was replaced by a single investigator who met with all the witnesses, took testimony, and then wrote a report. The investigator not only found facts but made conclusions into responsibility and made recommendations of sanctions. There was no hearing of a single investigator after a series of interviews. That report, which made conclusions as to fault and intention, was then reviewed on paper by a panel based solely on the paper submission. They either validated or altered or invalidated the findings of the investigator. And then there was, as you mentioned, a single appeal to the vice president. We've since fixed that, so there's now a final appeal. But the core feature of this is that it moved completely away from the hearing-based model to a sole investigator model as a way to address the problems under the code. That, however, you might guess, created other problems, and this explains why we're revisiting this and why we're rolling out these procedures we want to get your input on. What caused us to revisit? which is simply looking at the adjudication procedure. That is a part, an important, but it's only part of a much broader effort, because by the time you get to adjudicating the sexual assault or sexual misconduct claim, you're already at the last top of the block. It means education and prevention and cultural change has failed, and something bad has happened, and you're trying to determine responsibility and sanction. So your real effort, where the most productive effort comes, is in the earlier stages of education and prevention, and other groups are working on that. But our group is the type of working group, we're only working on the procedure. It consists of folks from multiple offices looking at this. We've consulted with many constituencies, as noted here, including these groups, and that's why we're making this second round of these conversations. We talked to here the new panel members, the involved professional complaints and finding advocates, all kinds of working groups. Resident here has a very strong and informed view of this, and we've also benchmarked what we're doing against multiple peer universities and colleges. This survey, comprehensive survey, revealed a number of concerns. The two chief ones are that, as you might have guessed, the absence of any hearing has created some substantial concern. For the respondent to defend, the absence of any hearing process where they can actually talk to the review panel is widely used, depriving them of some basic essentials of what we consider to be fair process. Now, the trick here is that, the actual increasing process. The trick here is as you increase process, increase formality, generate hearings, increase questioning, you begin to worry again about bottling up the process so that it begins to discourage victims from coming forward. And so it's trying to figure out how that tension works and where to locate the level of process so that you both have fair process and you, as much as possible, encourage people to come forward and make them victims of this misconduct. The thing that's worth noting is that there's another factor at play that actually suggests that it's also in the interest of victims in good enforcement to have sufficiently strong process. And that's that second bullet here. If for complaints, if you have a weak process, you have the danger that the finders of fact and the review panel will be uncertain enough about whether there's been sufficient process that they will actually fail to find culpability in cases where it exists, or they will fail to impose strong sanctions when they're deserved simply because the process is so weak and needed. So it's also in the interest of complaining to make sure that the process is strong enough and vigorous enough that review panels will impose sanctions and find culpability where appropriate. The review panels also have found that the weak process causes uncertainty, confusion, frustration. Faculty often go through one or two of these reviews where they're forced to read, simply make a judgment based on a paper record, and then they refuse to participate again on the grounds they simply don't have a good enough sense of what's going on. And there's other problems as well in terms of just the general lack of guidance in the process. A few more things and I'll turn it over to Carol. Procedures have been found to be hard to understand and follow. Our process provides respondents with advisors but not complainants. Very unclear standards for temporary suspension. We talked about the single investigator and the review panel members complain about lack of sufficient training and guidance. That's what we're trying to address. Carol will talk about a sort of beta version of the new process.
Good evening. I'm Cheryl from Matthew Heard. So this is an overview of what our proposed training is. First, regarding the scope, we're talking about developing procedures only in cases where students are responding and where they're charged with sexual harassment, although that is an open question, as you said, sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking. The procedures will stand alone. This will be part of policy 6.4, but as you saw from the slide that your sister showed you, there'll be a button for these procedures so that it will be easy, ideally, for students who are charged to find these, and similarly for students or others who we should be able to easily find any features that are applicable. We're also providing much more specificity. Right now, the features are very general, and so that creates a risk of inconsistent interpretation, confusion, etc. So we're going to create much more specificity that also to ask that standard approaches, etc. We'll also write in an accessible manner using plain English with a target audience of students. Probably this might be tailored to undergraduate level students, so that they'll be easy to follow. We're redefining the investigator's role. So as John told you, we have this single investigatory model where the investigator does everything. We're still retaining the core responsibilities of the investigator. So they'll meet with the respondent, meet with the complainant, they'll conduct additional interviews, gather evidence, et cetera. After they've done an exhaustive investigation, they'll send a preliminary report to the complainant and the respondent. Both parties will have an opportunity to respond. And based on the report, the response, the investigator will write a report. As you can see, the report will synthesize facts, they'll identify issues that are relevant to credibility, they'll highlight whether parties agree and whether they disagree, but they will stop short of making findings. So no finding of responsibility or lack of responsibility, and no determination on the ultimate issue of credibility. Also no recommendations for sanctions. So we will create a hearing component, I should say, but it will not be the type of hearing that students have in a typical conduct case. We think it will be much more balanced to protect the complainant, but also afford due process rights to respondents. So, for example, the complainant and respondent will never actually be physically together. They'll either be in separate rooms, well, they will be in separate rooms, but they can also participate remotely. The parties will be in terms of testify, and you'll see the words are very carefully chosen. Request witnesses, submit proposed questions, submit suggestions for evidence they want to admit. But they will not have the final say, nor will they conduct the questioning. The panelists, the hearing panel, will conduct all the questioning. And a hearing chair, and I'll talk about that in 1 minute, will make determinations and make final rulings on what is admitted. So what questions should be asked, what evidence is admitted, what witnesses ought to testify. Now, they will consult with the parties, they will consult with the panelists, and in some instances, questions that are relevant, that are not cumulative, that are not prejudicial, should be asked, but that will be up to the chair. The panel will be 3 members. Currently, the review panel, there is no hearing panel now, but there is a review panel, it's all faculty. We will be adding staff, so the hearing panel will have different faculty. Not students, very controversial issue, I believe, on this campus and nationwide. Ultimately, we decided not to include students, respecting the very strong point of view among students about faculty concerns. Feel uncomfortable, not so much as worry about technical violations of confidentiality, but feeling uncomfortable walking around the campus knowing that students know that they experience conduct or they've been charged with conduct. We will do annual training to service if complaints of the training has not been as substantial as we're about to show you. We'll do annual training as required by law, and so I'm interested, I can recite what that is. But both the Federal Violence Against Women Act and the New York State Legislation have very substantial training requirements. That's why the components of the training. The standard of proof will remain the preponderance of the evidence. I talked about the hearing chair, and I've met with many and they would ensure that the panelists would understand the procedure, understand how to interpret the standard of proof, what the preponderance of the evidence means, it's not very convincing, it's not the obvious or doubt, understand the evidence referred, talk with assessing credibility, etc. So not only ensure consistent and correct interpretation, but they'll serve as a gatekeeper, as I discussed in much detail earlier, about what is admissible. And they will also use this authority. They will not be a voting member of the panel. Here's some of the other considerations. Currently, as John mentioned, the respondent is afforded an advisor, and that's the judicial close counselors that are law students. But there's no analogous advisor for complaining. So we're adding another professional or a trained advisor, either in the form of a special staff member or potentially a law student, like a role like the JCC, or in preliminary discussions with the law student about this. If we were to do that, so it's a second role as I mentioned, and we would do it in the context of a law clinic, so that there would be a faculty member who is educating and supervising students in the two functions. Both the complainant and respondent would also be able to select their own advisor, so they'd be entitled to two advisors, and they would both be able to have, as we do now, a support person for their emotional support. The temporary suspension standard, we will use the standard that's articulated in the campus code, and it talks about extraordinary circumstances, it's understood to an extraordinary measure, calibrated to address risk, but also tailored to minimize to the extent possible the impact on a key student, as you can understand expulsion. From the university with less measures, appropriate that we want to make sure that it is. So we will have guidance in the procedures about that. What would constitute extraordinary circumstances? Such things as not limited to, but such things as repeated offenses, use of weapons, extreme violence, etc. We are adding an opportunity for alternate resolution. And this is another area that is controversial with parties or people having strange points of view on both sides. Under New York State law, and as a best practice, you are never allowed to mediate cases involving sexual assault and the like. So we're cognizant of that, but we like to try other forms of alternate resolution so that the parties can resolve the case with appropriate outcomes for a respondent without having to go to a hearing. Now, some of the victim rights advocates are concerned that complainant victims will feel pressured to avoid a prosecutor hearing if you exist, and that this might not be that. On the other hand, it's also been pointed out that there are a number of cases where complainants are not doing anything because of fear of going to the so as a way to ensure that there are educational and other appropriate outcomes in cases where complainants have been reluctant to go through the procedures, we're providing this opportunity, but we'll be very sensitive to this problem of pressure. So alternate resolution will have to be supervised by the trend line coordinator to make sure that this is that there is not undue pressure. And as I mentioned before, mediation and other face-to-face meetings is not permitted. So that's it. We welcome your questions and comments. I'll sit down with my colleagues so we can pass around the microphone. And we'd love to hear your reaction.
Thank you very much. So, we'll now open it up for any questions from the audience. And I'll ask you that you really, really, really speak up. The acoustics in this room aren't the best.
Or use a microphone.
If there's one near you. There should be some in the audience. All right.
Can you hear me? Yes. Okay. So this is not something I say often at Cornell, and I can really take an attest to that, but I actually think you've done a really good job with this policy.
Thank you.
Given that, I mean, I think it's unfortunate in the first place that our criminal justice system and policing are such that we feel that we can't trust it and need a whole other judicial system in the university. But given that that's the law, and that these are the best to give you, and having worked on these issues at another university in a more formal capacity, hats off to you. I do have some concerns, though, and specifically involving advisors, adjudicators, all these staff involved. How are you going to ensure that, you know, to make this process work, you need a large pool of staff, you need people who are committed? You know, I think a problem that's been brought up in a lot of places is when the university gets involved in adjudicating these cases, the process can really drag out. In part just because of lack of staffing, lack of incentives, people are sensitive to these issues and, you know, get them to some extent. Is there the funding in place to maybe even pay some of the people who are adjudicating? And also, in terms of student advisors, you're talking about the fact that you don't want students adjudicating the cases, but you're then going to want students to advise the cases. And I know the JJC, or even last year, they're great, but, you know, that's sort of a tension there. I think. What are your opinions?
Those are all very good questions, and we've struggled with them. What you see here is the basic architecture of a revised system. The implementation has just, and this is a month of work and thinking, the implementation is at least twice as difficult. In other words, to get this thing to work on the ground is very challenging. There are particular challenges around staffing, quality, and so forth. It's a small town, as you know, and some of these require law-trained people. There's a lot of law-trained people. That's a good lot of law-trained people. People don't want to do this. So we are thinking very carefully about how to fill these areas of seats. We're thinking carefully about the role and how to maintain the quality of people in these positions. We're thinking about the potential conflict or overlap between roles. And we're thinking about resources, because this does involve at least having one or two staff positions with a very, very tight budget. We've had conversations directly with President Harris, who in many ways is looking for places to economize. This is one place he's very committed to having whatever staffing is necessary so that we are not only complying with all the federal and state mandates, but more importantly, doing right by students, complainants, respondents, all students generally. And so we do believe we will be able to sufficiently create the positions. We have to work very hard to fill up the right staffing. But again, this is the implementation is critical. We have the most beautifully designed process here, but if we don't have the right people in the right roles, it will fail in practice. So we do worry about that. Part of Carol's due diligence going around and talking to people was to find out how people were actually engaged in the process in terms of review panel members and investigators and other parties, our experience to be on the ground to get a sense of what we can do to make these roles work well.
I just might add that I do find it complaining because two of the people involved work for me. They are two full-time Catalan investigators. That's been approved and is in place. It's also been approved to add a chief Catalan coordinator role. The current chief Catalan coordinator has multiple roles and is actually leaving the university, and there has been a funding approved for a full-time Catalan coordinator. So those places are in place. There are a lot of other places in place too, but I just want to assure you those.
Hi, thanks. My question is how do you measure the quality of your adjudicators, your panelists there, and how will you like track that?
I'm just telling you it's a hard question.
we're not allowed to, we're not understanding the proper standard of proof to have a chair to address all that. And so that role is really key, and you understand that really well.
Step
into
the challenge. So we have to think this through. Currently, the dean of faculty provides faculty members. It's not a perfect system. It's complicated. As Carol mentioned, the review panel chair has two functions that are important. One is what she mentioned, is that the review panel chair, because they're going to be every single year as opposed to rotating amongst the faculty, will be every single year to provide continuity guidance. Panel on track. The second is the review panel chair is able in round two to say we need to eliminate this person from the array. They, we can remove people if we see within the context of the hearing clearly not up to it. We don't have that mechanism right now.
Any other questions? There's one back there.
Hi. I have two questions, if you don't mind. First is that these issues, for those of us, especially with limited funding, as we're pushing for short time to degree, if a case comes up, can massively derail our academic career, derail our time to graduation. If Cornell is willing to consider amending our funding packages, if something like this talks about it, on a case-by-case basis,
we haven't addressed that. We're aware of the time impact and the delays that these cause. It hasn't been addressed in policy. It's something we can consider. I'm the Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, so I work with the dean department on many of these general issues. I would want to think about whether that's something you embed in a policy or instead you try to get what should happen. I think sort of intuitively is that the department chair, PhD committees are able to deal with this in a case by case basis. Good point. It's part of a bigger question about what time frame can you get these to run on effectively. There's a desire for an expeditious and efficient resolution. At the same time, you don't want to rush the judgment. So we balance that currently between the parties. That's something I had thought about a little bit. Do you have another question?
And it also includes the but yes, another question. You mentioned department chair committees, although the policy only covers students on students from the department. The AAU survey showed a significant percentage of faculty or staff from graduates or from harassment. I know Cornell classes with harassment on the outside of the university at a conference. I know some guys have seen them who harass someone here. Is there a publicized and enforced way of dealing with these breaches in the current conduct?
Apparently not publicized enough. Policy 6.4, the part that you remember, which you saw in the list of complaints and responses, presently has and has for a long time provided a mechanism for any community member
think we have time for one more question, and then we can email additional questions as well. So email is up here, as well. If you want, you can just email them to me, and I'll get them forwarded along, and we'll try to respond as quickly. So one more question. Thank you. If there's any additional comments and concerns, again, you can communicate those by email. One last thing. So what kind of timeline would we expect for any additional sort of announcements? Thinking January or before the end of the semester? Or? Going out towards the end of the but we have this one as out.
I'm going to be Typically, if you go to any one of these events, you would more or less recover
friends that I have, intercool interest in stocking lurch. Most prominent is probably the dry fall that occurs in the spring. We were a little bit concerned about during the last appropriation cycle. The dry fall was very nice. It was also very expensive, even after accounting for ticket sales. It accounted for about 2/3 of the GCSC budget. And I was very amazed with them. Some of this was due to unforeseen circumstances and things that came up that they couldn't control. So they feel that in the future they can operate on a good budget. So that's why I recommend a slight decrease from $3 to $2.22 and get rid of it and still offer
the primary review for the team is not here today because she has to think of what's up after dinner. The So the reason why we didn't listen to GPS recommendation was this big discussion about the grocery store, which is going to happen in the next couple of meetings. I don't know exactly what timeline for that is yet. So basically, there is going to be a grocery store that is going to be started for food insecure students and for all students on campus. It's going to be located in Amazon State of Hall. Right now, to spark that opposition up, the SA is funding $300,000. And they have come to us saying that they needed $80,000 over the next 4 years. The reason they want this money is that it ensures that we are buying into their system and we are providing financial support for them. And this will enable grad students to also utilize the facility. If we don't provide funding right now, the status is that they will not, it won't be open to grad students. And so that's something that they have requested. And they need funding only for 4 years, not for an extended period of time. And so one way we could have done it is have a separate environment of funded them. But that it goes against like the spirit of the environment of in the sense that they would live along for a long time. And if it's something that's small that's a project that the GPSA wants to take up, then it should be part of our application or something that we have control over. And so one of the in talking to the executive committee, what we felt was best was it should be part of the GPS application for all the reasons that we talked about. To fund this, we need to have a separate resolution saying that we are going to fund this as part of the GPS application, and that will be a super majority vote. So 2/3 of the voting members have to vote on it and approve it. And for this, we will adjust the aggregate fee to include the grocery store. There is a slight issue with this because that grocery store is not completely updated, and on number 15, the president will weigh in on this issue, and we are waiting to hear from the president before we can actually vote on it. If the president says no, then we don't need to vote on it. And that's one of the reasons why we're waiting. And so right now, the GPS's recommendation, what we think the GPS does, and we have been getting $1.95 and the same dollar, no increase in our operating budget. One thing that we have been doing is reducing the rollover that we operate at a slightly higher budget, but we have a lot of rollover funds that we use to just basically start new projects or new committees. And we have reduced this, which is the same for everybody on the home, which we don't want them to hoard money that we are giving. So we will visit this again when we know more about the activity. So then, about the grocery store, then this will become $4.50. Currently, the GPHFC, which is the Finance Commission, also is supposed their budget also needs to be approved. And right now, the way it's set up is going to be $30.50. There are over 300 student groups, graduate student groups that are funding the GPHFC. It is the best. Value for your money. So the number of groups that get funding from here and that things that happen is so immense that the $30 that goes into it is the most value for money that you get out of that thing. So right now the plan is grocery store. What we want to do is we'll decrease SAS's allocation by 50 cents, increase the GPS allocation by 50 cents. And then we'll add another $2 to that. That we don't increase the activity by the $3, which is what the requirement will be. And what this will assure is that the GPSA will give us some of the rollover funds so that we are not asking students who are coming in for something that we want to fund completely. So we can use rollover that we have already have to fund this. And all of this has to be again voted through the GPSA. And again, for this, there should be a certain authority to go through. And so what will happen because of this is that the GPA allocation will go from $2 to $4.50. The violence fund, but then the GPSA allocation will increase a little bit from 1366 to 1716. And that is still more than what they are we have required to give, and the total activity will come $35. In view of all this, what we're going to do next week is we are going to
Can you use the microphone, please?
They want an explanation from the grocery store.
An explanation from the grocery store? So,
yeah. That's the opposite.
So we had the second meeting of this semester, we had a presentation from them, the grocery store, what we're trying to do. We'll have someone at our next meeting to also ask more questions from the grocery store. Generally speaking, this is response to a survey that went out to undergraduate students. We're right now trying to get survey data on graduate students as well. So it indicated that there's a fairly high prevalence of food insecurity crime. I think the most general term is, had you skipped a meal due to financial concerns, things like that. And apparently, I can't remember what the number was, but it was 10-20% of graduates reported being food insecure. So the grocery store is going to be a low-cost grocery store, and there's also going to be subsidies for students who are food insecure on top of the fact that they're exposed to low cost to try and help food insecure students get access to food. So again, we're going to have a lot more professional questions for later, but I don't want to tie up all of our comments and questions. They're good questions to be thinking about. Just to answer that one briefly, they are going to be, they say that since they're not paying rent, they're not paying utilities, and they're getting their employment through work-study programs, they can keep their costs lower than a private organization and, of course, a nonprofit. And it's not just about low cost, it's also about access. So it's located at Animal Taylor right on campus, but they claim there's better access for students who live like in the College Town area or again, they'll be here to answer some of those. I can only say what they've claimed to me, but these are all good questions to be thinking about when we think about which one we will look into. And of course, we'll vote on this. There will be a two-thirds supermajority. We will have a lot more time for discussion on the grocery store specifically, but now we probably move on to the other questions. But yeah, keep these questions in mind. They'll have representatives at our next meeting, and then we're also looking at getting survey data to see exactly what kind of food insecurity is there among graduate students.
Hi. So I'm the GCSA appointed member on the Cornell Student Advisory Board, and I just wanted to express a couple of concerns that I have regarding the recommendation of the Cornell Student Advisory Board. At first, I was very happy to see that the committee acknowledged the need and value of Cornell Student Advisory Board, and was upfront about the fact that Cornell Student Advisory Board has incurred major necessary costs. And full detail in the appropriations of the document. But I think the one thing that I just want to mention so that everyone knows is that in 2008, and 2010, and 2012, during those funding cycles, Cornell Student Advisory Board's GPSA guideline funding was $11 per student. Okay? And $11 per time. And if you look at those numbers adjusted by inflation, using BLS data, CPI, inflation, things like that, that's $12 and like $11.50 in those past cycles. And so while I'm glad that there's a willingness to sort of reverse the austerity that was performed during the last funding cycle, I'm still a little bit concerned that this is still substantially lower than both sort of freight dollars and then real inflation-adjusted dollars than quantum was prior to that. And I think that the committee has acknowledged that quantum has taken very substantial steps to decrease their costs, increase publicity, and exposure to graduate students. And I want to mention that this, you know, it's true that CC is about 20% of the rising graduate students. That's not to say that 80% is undergraduate. About 60% is undergraduate, and then 20% is from the community at large. So that means that, as the community said, okay, there are three times as many undergraduates as many graduate students. Just notice that there are twice as many undergraduates as graduate students. So the actual percentages of that 80% that Cornell Cinema, their audience is students, the difference between the sort of ideal amount would be about 26-63 versus 20-60 is not very large. I just want to point out that discrepancy with the data or that issue with the way to present it, and just make sure that everyone is aware that while this is a reversal, this is still much lower than it was in previous years. I think Cornell Cinema is a very valuable organization, and they're an artistic organization, and I'm proud of the way they've achieved.
point out we are now running close to the end of our scheduling time. We do have a full other meeting devoted to this. Our next regular meeting is all on the activity and more in-depth discussion of each individual item, but I think we can probably do one more question. Do you have a response to it?
We can talk about it.
Seeing no dissent, we'll extend by 5 minutes. Alright, so other questions?
Environmental health. At the very least, that 150, I guess, is sort of that I would imagine would be a part of the outreach and the training that they give to other graduates.
Okay. Are there any other questions? And you and I will have a much more in-depth discussion on this at our next meeting, which will be almost entirely devoted to the equity.
Okay. Motion to adjourn.
There's a motion to adjourn. Second. Okay. We are adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.